Military Installations, population 193, and Prudhoe Bay Resource Development District, population 7,843. The borough encompasses 88,281 square miles of land and nearly 800 miles of Arctic coastline, constituting 15% of the state, and is the largest municipality in the U.S. I got the impression that Mr. Dubé was addressing his remarks to you, Mr. Lerner, and seemed most supportive of what you had said yesterday. Do you want to add anything?
I shall, but I'm not going to now. One of the few things I heard about Indians before I got here, and maybe it's apocryphal, was that in those negotiations between whites and Indians in the eastern United States, when the whites made a proposal, it was regarded as rude to respond to someone's proposal on the same day that he heard it. It would suggest that you were flippant and took it casually. If you slept on it, then you showed that you had thought about what was saying rather than just sort of giving something off the top of the head. I don't know that I will sleep on it, but I want to think about what you said some more before I respond.
Just before we adjourn then for lunch, Ralph Johnson, did you want to say anything about Mr. Dubé's explanation of the genesis of notions of sovereignty?
Well, I am not going to add anything. I thought it was a highly articulate and accurate description of the various ways that sovereignty can be defined, and it is important to keep in mind that sovereignty is a many-splendored thing. He's described that historically and practically and very capably. Delighted to see him.
Well, that seems to be a... Oh, Ada Deer.
I have many thoughts, but I particularly wanted to address something that Mr. Parker said, having to do with the roles of religion and the legal system, the intrusions into the villages. I feel that, and I'm sorry that he's not here at the moment, but I feel that his characterization is somewhat oversimplified in stating that the villages can be selective, for example, in their relationship with the religious groups in particular. I view the role of the church and of religion as something that has been extremely detrimental to native cultures across the world, and I think that it's important for everyone to question the roles and the functions of churches today. And in my opinion, the Christian religions in particular have done severe damage to many native cultures in separating and alienating individuals from the native religion and culture, and are responsible for a lot of the factionalism that exists today.
That was Mr. Tito Naranjo who made that last observation. Well, we'll adjourn till 1:15. And then we'll hear from Alma Yupikson and Kim Gottschalk of the Native American Rights Fund. NARF.
whenever you feel you might want to do this film that Nanhanjo brought, he has to leave tomorrow, so we should really do it today.
Yeah.
What we're going to do is just set a box up here and put the TV on top of this. But people will have to move in quite close because we're only have a small television set.
Okay. And it's about the Navajo.
Yeah. Well, you could ask him to describe it.
Yeah.
And it'll only take us about 5 minutes to set up, if that.
So if we did it about three, it's an hour long?
Yeah, roughly.
So let's do that. Okay. Yeah. Well, let's get together again. That film, Tito, is about the Navajo. Is there any? Has it got a title? That film? No.
Just for the record, you might just read this into the thing. There's no need for us to tape this.
No. What I thought we would do this afternoon, if it's agreeable, is hear from Ralph Lerner, if he has anything further to say by way of rejoinder to Bill Dubé, and then from Alma Upixen and Kim Gottschalk and Alfred Starr and Daley Sambo. And if it's agreeable, Tito Naranjo has brought a film that is about the Navajo Nation, America's largest and most enduring Indian tribe, have kept their native language, 40,000 of them still speak no English. Only recently has their language been written, since their culture has been handed down verbally through the elders of the tribe, and so on. Mr. Naranjo says this is really a film illustrating progress towards self-determination. So, since Tito has to leave tomorrow, I think we might show this at 3 and cluster in here around the television set to watch it. Perhaps some of you have seen it, but I haven't. And you've seen it? Well, I think we should. Well, did you have anything to say, Mr. Lerner, in response to Bill Dubé's remarks?
I don't want to say it's in response to it in the sense that I'm answering, though he set me in thinking about some matters, though I can't say, and you will confirm it, that I had much chance during lunch to turn my thoughts to it, since we talked about faraway places, very far away from Alaska. The connection between peoplehood and the land is a very provocative one. The American people, under the Constitution, step back from that. The American people, in their primary, foremost national act, constitute themselves a people in the Declaration of Independence. And in the first paragraph of it, they talk about a people separate from other peoples. When in the course of human events it becomes necessary for a people to assume that separate and equal station. Yes? Who are the American people? why don't they include the people from your country, Mr. Berger? I mean, why did they stop short of New Brunswick, Prince Edward's Island? Why didn't they include other English-speaking peoples in the Barbados, the British West Indies? I don't think that you can say that it was a pattern laid up in heaven, that the American people would consist of 13 colonies and only 13. There are probably around 16 British colonies, English-speaking colonies, on the eastern coast of North America at the time. I'm leaving the Quebecers aside. And yet the Declaration starts from the premise that, of course, the Americans are a people, you know, the usual way in which lawyers like to argue. You assume the thing to be proved and take it from there. I sometimes wondered about that. And the remarks that Mr. Dubay made and that others have stirred in talking about this brought back some of my earlier wonder and misgivings about it. The American people in 1776 seem to have been a people, surely not as Mr. Dubay spoke of, an autochthonous people, people that grew up out of the earth. That's utterly impossible. They were all greenhorns. They're all people who just got off the boat, so to speak, either the day before or the year before or the century before. They're all newcomers. So they're not a people by virtue of their having grown up out of this soil. They're a people by virtue of their proclaiming themselves a people, seeing themselves a people, thinking of themselves as a people, acting as a people. It doesn't turn on race. It doesn't turn on religion, because they weren't a uniform people in either of those respects. But it turned on a certain political self-definition that they were in a position to do something about. And they thought that the basis of that lay in certain rights founded not on their peoplehood, but on their individual character, the inalienable rights that were owing to them as individuals, and by virtue of which they could constitute themselves a people and form a government that would secure those rights to them, each and every one of them. That was, to use the language that was mentioned earlier by Mr. Chamberlain, a vision. Quite at odds with the prevailing notions of the time. And they tried to act on that vision. I'm very far from being disdainful of visions, though I'm wary of them. Maybe we live by visions that we have. Maybe to the extent that we're incapable of having any, we're already dead. But, you know, there are visions and visions. If I put my hand in my jacket, button it up, and go around proclaiming myself Napoleon, you're not obliged to believe me. There might be a social worker around who'd be prepared to commit me somewhere. So, I'm really struck by things that Mr. Naranjo and Mr. Jim have raised. The fact that another doesn't see it doesn't mean that it isn't there. Doesn't mean that it is there either. So one has to be pretty careful about the kind of visions one pursues. Can I get in the spirit of this place, which has been to tell stories? I'll tell a story. I haven't told stories really since my children were little. There was a famous Jewish general who lost a battle and a war. During the revolution of the Jewish people against the Roman Empire. And his fame rests not on his having lost the battle and the war, but on the history that he wrote of it, kind of participant's account. So when the conquering Roman general entered the temple in Jerusalem in the year 76, and strode in, as I'm sure a conquering Roman general would, not amble in, but strode in to the temple, where, of course, only Jews were admitted, and strode into the Holy of Holies, in which only one person was admitted on one day in the entire year, and that only for a special prayer at a special moment, namely the high priest on the Day of Atonement. This Roman general strode in to the Holy of Holies in the temple and looked in, and he said, "It's empty. There's nothing there." Well, I guess the moral of that story is a vision isn't necessarily everyone's vision. And one can be blind to things if one is only looking for the tangible, the material, the transportable. So all that is a roundabout way of saying that the native peoples have visions of their own to pursue, but they have to be careful in a way that only they can tell about which visions they mean to pursue. I suppose Handsome Lake had a vision, and the prophet had a vision. I wonder whether in talking about the vision of the Inuit and the Aleuts and the Indians in Alaska, one runs the risk of taking rather diverse people with diverse visions, diverse and maybe equally legitimate wants and hopes and fears, and squeezing them into a convenient little package, which will then be marketed to the world at large or to the BIA or to Washington or Congress as what, quote, the Inuit want. Somewhere I seem to recall having read that the whole notion of tribe, I'm speaking now of, say, Eastern United States, Indians, was a construct of anthropologists. Am I mistaken in this? I don't know. I may have heard it. That doesn't mean that it's either right or wrong. That it was easier to think of and deal with the complex interrelations among various Indian groups and families and clans and Lord knows what else by putting them in this thing which is called a tribe. You now have a handle. You can deal with someone. You can sign paper. From the things that I had read in the earlier papers, especially Ms. Finup Reardon's summary of the earlier testimony, I was impressed by the variety of Indians and Aleuts and Eskimos and the variety of their hopes, not only their contradictoriness in some ways, because that could be quite human within one person, yes, that you want things that don't go well together, but that they may really be different peoples. And if you're talking about, if we are talking about self-government now, self-determination, avoiding that whole baggage of misleading and possibly terrifying and possibly unproductive overtones of sovereignty, if we're talking about self-determination of peoples, of a right of a people to institute such governments as to them seem proper to secure their inalienable rights, their pursuit of happiness, then I suppose we want to be careful that we don't take those subgroups and ride roughshod over them, fit them into whatever prevailing notions a temporary majority might have of what's the right way of thinking and the wrong way of thinking. One wants to avoid the tyranny of the white man over the red man, but I suppose if these are all indeed human beings, as I take it we're all agreed they are, one wants to avoid any kind of tyranny, whether it bears a red hand or a white hand. It's not better for being red. The final thought I would raise about this is that to add to the complications and the human dilemma that's involved here, it may be that the legitimate aspirations of one group to make X out of themselves, whatever that is, to pursue the traditional life of subsistence and living in perfect harmony with the world as removed as possible from the world of plastic, or the legitimate aspirations of another group to enter into the mainstream of Western life, retaining such elements of the tradition as to them see, as they see fit. It may be that those competing aspirations and programs, if pursued, will have terrible consequences for others with other aspirations and other hopes and other plans for themselves. Even if you've got 44 million acres or whatever it is, or to sort of work it out. One people says, let's go for oil, and in doing so, make it impossible for other people far, far away to do what they've been used to doing. I don't know how one resolves that. I'm saying that that's yet another aspect of the sense in which we've got a problem of the native peoples, for the native peoples to decide, and where it's not going to be appreciably easier than it would be, or more comfortable, I should say, than it would be for the white man to decide it for them. All this is not to say that it's hopeless, but to say that it seems to demand every resource of thoughtfulness and introspection that you can muster. And it's an area in which lawyers are a late and limited resource. The problems begin at home, and they have to start, the resolution of those problems, it seems to me, have to start there. And probably it's an area in which you have very little guidance from the experience of mankind.
Thank you, Mr. Lerner. Well, I think that we should hear now from the representatives of Native American Rights Fund, Alma Upixin and Kim Gottschalk. So, Alma, if you'd like to proceed now.
Thank you. As a means of introduction, I am a Nubat. I grew up here in Anchorage, recent law graduate, and have been working for NAR for about 5 months. I'm an Arctic Slope shareholder and would like to get back to some of the questions we had talked about earlier about Western institutions looking at the corporation as a means of implementing that. First, I would like to come back to the discussions we had yesterday, partly from Mr. Lerner's presentation, questions about individual and group rights. To begin, and talking with Mr. Lerner and some others, federal Indian law, U.S. federal Indian law as a field is something that is very unique and oftentimes misunderstood. And those concepts and ideas have been a basis in many instances for looking at ANCSA. ANCSA was a development in many instances of federal Indian law and policy, and it has to be viewed in that way. As well, looking at the legal aspects of ANCSA, looking at the policy from which it's developed, I think it also needs to be understood in other aspects, how the law has affected the people. I think Mr. Chamberlain and Rosita and others have emphasized that and looked at those aspects. And that is one area which I want to talk about specifically in regards to some of Mr. Chamberlain's comments about corporations. He had inferred that it was the people's visions that should more or less influence those institutions, the language. And it's something that I think is very difficult for people outside Alaska, people even in Alaska, to understand. ANCSA imposed a corporate system as a means of settling the land and money issue. And I first had contact with the idea of a corporation, what it was and how it was set up, when I went up to Barrow, and went there specifically to work for the corporation and to find out more about what ANCSA was, how it was being implemented, and what it actually meant. And I knew very little of this, and this was at a time when I was in college. I think that's the case with many people, lawyers, non-lawyers, that there's a lot of misinformation, a lot of things that are not understood, how the land is held, et cetera. And I was very disillusioned in my exposure and frustrated about many things I saw. And in speaking with one of our attorneys, was told that the frustrations I had about the role of the corporation, what it was doing in many instances, could be answered in this way, that the corporation was set up as a business entity to make profit. And I think that is the view of many Native leaders, many of the attorneys who work with the corporation, work with the individual people in the corporation. And we had talked, the discussion had gone into looking at other institutions, other means of fulfilling the goals and the dreams of Native peoples when they looked at the corporation, what it was. I think we had talked about the North Slope Borough as well. I think the Arctic Slope might be a unique situation where you have a regional corporation. You also have a local government composed of Native people, which is able to offer through tax monies from oil development services, which other areas could not provide. That is not the situation in most parts of Alaska. And I think the contrast there between what the corporation is doing and how it's meeting some of those those goals is a much much more of a struggle. Apart from those problems, I think looking at the corporate mode in the village sense, you have a problem which is even more intensified. My village corporation, for instance, and I'm sure many others have had this problem, even in complying with state laws to stay incorporated, has posed problems. And I think it's hard to understand, looking at a people's with a new idea and how that's being implemented. And I wanted to come back to Ada Deer and talk more about the corporate system that was set up there. They had a state chartered system. What has been the effect of a corporation as a means of implementing a policy or a means of implementing actions that are directly tied to the people?
Did you want Ada Deer to respond to that?
If she would.
Again, I want to emphasize that the corporate model was imposed on our people. The Menominee people did not understand the corporate structure, and the termination plan, as it was finally implemented, had several layers and boards. I'm sorry, I don't have my book here. Another person is using it at the moment. But at any rate, there were foreign structures superimposed over the former tribal structure. And so the people did not from the beginning understand the corporate structure, and all during the termination period, in my opinion, most of the people did not understand the corporate structure. I mentioned earlier the mill and how it was being operated and the lack of administrative and managerial expertise that is needed to run an operation. And now efforts are being made to train people, but this again is under the direction and the will of the Menominees. We want to have our own people at all levels in the structure of the mill, which has been converted from a state corporation now back to a tribal corporation. The problems still are with us in terms of the unemployment, but the people have, through their board of directors, made the basic decision that it's more important to employ people and not make such a high profit or even lose money than it is to have a high rate of unemployment, as it first occurred when termination took place in the early years. We're not through yet in terms of making this more responsive to the needs of the people, and I think that this is something that the Native people here and others that are involved need to keep in mind, how to make institutions, you know, more responsive to the needs. I'd be happy to answer some specific questions if I can.
Anything further, Wilma?
Kim Gottschalk.
Would you like to carry on from there?
Well, I'd like to start off by making the same disclaimer that Mr. Lerner made when he started off, and that is, this is my first trip to Alaska, and so I don't purport to have any special expertise. As I understand it, the one reason we're here is to see if there's anything we can offer about our background from the lower 48 that might be relevant. And so, given the understanding, I realize everything I say is subject to different application up here because of circumstances of which I'm not fully aware. I'd like to address a few comments to, I guess, the subject from the lower 48 that I may have the most experience with, which is the General Allotment Act, and how that might be relevant up here. And I want to say also it's been a privilege for me to listen to the eloquent statements given by Mr. Naranjo and Russell Jim this morning, and to hear the other people talk about the Alaskan vision or visions. There is, however, one thing that has me worried, and that is there almost seems to be an underwriting presumption that ANCSA is a mutually agreed upon temporary arrangement, and that we're Alaskan natives should stop and think about what their vision is, and then let's implement it. Also related to this is Mr. Lerner's comment that attorneys are a late and limited resource. And I feel that in one sense that's very true. I think lawyers can just muddy the waters if they're brought in too soon. And if the presumption is that we're looking just at a long-term solution of what the native vision is, then I agree with that statement. Unfortunately, ANCSA is a reality, and 1991 is very close at hand. And I think the response that happens to ANCSA before 1991 may have a lot to do with whether any vision, whatever it may be, has any hope of succeeding. And I base my statement on that in large part on the history of the General Allotment Act in the United States and the parallels that I see between the General Allotment Act and ANCSA. And once again, there may be factors up here which are going to render whatever I have to say irrelevant, but for whatever value it does have, I would like to discuss it a little more. I realize it was covered by Mr. Jorgensen, but I'd like to go into a little bit more detail. The General Allotment Act, of course, was similar to ANCSA in that it provided for a restriction on alienation of land which was allotted to individual Indians. And the reason land was allotted to individual Indians was I suppose to a large extent similar to the reasoning behind ANCSA, namely make land available for Anglo society, because once the allotments were issued, any surplus land was available for sale then and settlement by the Anglo population. They were also similar in that there was a problem with afterborn, so to speak, because land became more and more fragmented, and the same problem is faced here with those children who are not eligible for shares, so you have a real continuity problem. They were also similar in that there were limited restrictions on alienability and taxation during what was felt to be a transition period. But there was one important difference which gave the Indians under the General Allotment Act actually more protection than the natives have under ANCSA, which was that the President of the United States was given discretion to unilaterally extend the trust period on allotments, and in fact did so, and probably thereby saved what few were saved. And
Mr. Gottschalk, that was a 20-year period, was it?
25.
25.
Yes.
And the president was given discretion to extend the 25-year period.
That's right, and did so. And ultimately, it was then extended by Congress.
And I see. Yeah.
Now, for whatever reason, prior to the expiration of the 25-year period, some Indians wanted their land in fee, and they would go to Congress, and Congress would pass special bills granting an individual Indian a patent in fee. Also about this time, the Supreme Court, in a case called In Re Heff, ruled that an Indian became a citizen of the United States at the time of the issuance of the allotment, and not at the time of the expiration of the trust period, which had been the intent of Congress. That decision was subsequently overruled, and Congress, immediately after the Heff decision, made clear that it had not intended to grant citizenship at the time of the issuance of the allotment, but rather at the time the fee was issued. And this had important jurisdictional ramifications as to whether an Indian was a citizen or not in those days. To counteract In Re Heff, Congress in 1906 passed the Burke Act, which was to eliminate the Supreme Court's decision as to when an Indian became a citizen, and also was to do away with the need for individual Indians to come to Congress for a special bill to obtain a patent in fee. And so what they did is they stated that the Secretary of the Interior had the authority to issue fees when in his when he felt that the person was ready to handle that. And it's obvious from the congressional debates and the overall surrounding circumstances that the act was only intended to apply to Indians who wanted their patents in fee. And although there wasn't application language in the act, that seemed clear, and in fact that's how the act was interpreted for 10 years after it was passed by the Secretary of the Interior. So if an Indian applied, then a determination was made of competency. Even at that point, there were terrible consequences of allotment. No one knew what it meant to say that the Indian was ready to have the patent in fee. There were examples of fraud and duress, overreaching by Anglos who desired land to induce Indians to apply for fee patents, and then they immediately bought it at a very low price and turned around and made a profit on it. But things got worse because as the pressure for increased land grew, the policy was changed to, well, let's go out and find the competent Indians. Whether they want a fee patent or not, let's go find them and then issue them. And so that went on for a while, and that was perceived as too slow a process. So then they said, well, if you stop and think about it, I guess we can all agree that if someone has more than half white blood, they must be competent. And so they just got a blood roll, went down the list and looked at blood quantum, and if the person fell on one side or the other, they got issued a patent or didn't. And then it was changed to, well, if it's exactly 50% white blood, that's sufficient. And many Indians were fighting in World War I in France for their country and came back to find their land was now held in fee, but not only that, was on the block, soon to be sold. And so they would take out mortgages or whatever to stave that off, and then eventually the mortgages were foreclosed. The result of the policy, which I guess is really the point of this whole thing, is that millions of acres of land were lost. Many people were issued policy patent fees. That's, in other words, based on the quantum of blood that they had. Even when that person had individually applied for a patent previously and been determined not to be eligible for a patent. In other words, they were found not to be competent to handle their own affairs. But under the policy patent, then they would automatically be issued one nevertheless. People in Washington were telegraphing friends in South Dakota of who was going to be placed on the list to receive patent and fees, so those people could approach those people and sign contracts even before the patents and fee were issued. Of course, those contracts were illegal under the Allotment Act. Not only were millions of acres lost, but it has also created a jurisdictional nightmare. And what I am worried about is the frightening parallel between ANCSA and its very limited restrictions on stock and et cetera, and the General Allotment Act and what happened. And if I were to guess without having all the facts available to me on the situation in Alaska, well, let's put it this way. I'm very frightened at what's going to happen, and I think if something is not done before 1991, many of the visions that I've talked about will become geometrically harder of achievement, because the tribes in the lower 48 who were submitted to allotment have not yet, and I doubt ever will, recover from it.
Could I ask you a question, Mr. Gottschalk? When a reserve reservation was when the reserve was allotted, carved up into allotments for each adult male, you said the surplus was then available for sale to the general public. Do you mean that if once there had been allotments to all the male adults in the tribe, that didn't take up all the land they had, then the